Arkansas prepares once again to roll out a work requirement for some Medicaid recipients. A new report looks at the state of the workforce in Northwest Arkansas and what are state officials doing to help curb the spread of a dangerous parasite. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. This month, the Arkansas Department of Human Services soft-launched new work requirements for the state's Medicaid expansion program. KUAF's Daniel Carruth has more details.
On July 1st, the Arkansas Department of Human Services launched its new welfare-to-work requirements for adults enrolled in the Arkansas Health and Opportunity for Me, or ARHOME, Medicaid program. It's an initiative that Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders has been pushing for since taking office. Here she is announcing the work requirement plan at a press conference in 2025.
220,000 able-bodied working age adults in Arkansas receive free health care courtesy of the Arkansas taxpayer. It cost us more than $2.2 billion each year and growing. Of those recipients, estimates show that nearly 90,000 have no job.
The new rules require Medicaid and ARHOME recipients age 19 to 64 to work, volunteer, or attend school at least 20 hours per week, though penalties won't begin until January 1st. State officials say the phased approach will give Medicaid recipients time to adjust to the reporting system. The new guidelines are part of a broader federal push mandated under the Trump administration's Big Beautiful Bill Act, signed in 2025, to cut Medicaid costs, and come nearly 7 years after a federal judge struck down an Arkansas law instituting such work requirements. Arkansas was the first state in the nation to institute this kind of program. Laura Harker is a policy researcher for the nonprofit Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and analyzed Arkansas's 2018 program, which she says left 18,000 people uninsured.
So a lot of people were finding out at the point of their care when they really needed it, and that often left them to be sicker. They were not able to work because they didn't have their prescriptions or they weren't able to get their care. So that essentially left them to lose their job, which means they aren't able to report hours to get their coverage back. So it kind of just creates this cycle. It's supposed to be encouraging work, but instead it tends to punish folks who are working and really need that health coverage to continue working.
Harker says many Medicaid recipients actually already work and that implementing these new systems will likely end up costing Arkansas more money.
States are spending millions of dollars contracting with companies or having to hire new caseworkers to meet the demand, to answer questions, to try to verify all of these different exemptions or work hours. So it just is a lot of extra bureaucracy for something that is not truly an issue that exists. Most people in Medicaid are working already or have other reasons where they may not be.
She also says coverage losses will have an impact on hospital systems in the state, specifically in rural areas and small towns, where roughly 28% of residents depend on Medicaid for coverage. Dr. Julie Graylow is Chief Medical Officer and Executive Vice President of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And she says these new guidelines increase the burden on some of the most vulnerable populations, like cancer patients.
Those who meet this frailty exemption for the work requirement are the people who are least able to track and regularly report and get through the processes of all of the administrative burden in order to qualify. And there will be gaps, not because you're not eligible for the exemption, but because you just can't manage the system and get things in on time. And if you've got delays in your coverage, that could have real life-threatening implications for a patient.
The program allows exemptions for pregnant and postpartum women, former foster children under the age of 26, parents or caregivers of children under 14, veterans with a total disability rating, people enrolled in Medicare, and those who can prove medical frailty. Grelow says petitioning for and maintaining these waivers, though, puts too much burden on those who qualify for coverage and could cost people life-saving care.
Well, what we learned from that Arkansas experiment, if you will, is that roughly one in four people who were subject to the work mandate lost their health coverage, not because they were no longer eligible for the exemption of the work hours, but because they couldn't navigate the reporting portals and document their medical exemptions in a timely way. One in four during that prior model, that prior pilot. So I don't know why it would be any different this time. And actually, it looks like the reporting is going to be more frequent and more onerous. So it could be much higher. And that has real life-threatening implications for people dealing with a cancer diagnosis.
On July 1st, Arkansas Department of Human Services began an automated process of verifying eligibility and compliance with the new guidelines. The department says recipients will receive a notice detailing whether they meet the upcoming requirements. Last month, the department launched a new web portal, access.arkansas.gov, to help Medicaid recipients manage their information. According to numbers from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, around 710,000 Arkansans, 23% of the state's population, are enrolled in Medicaid as of March, while 210,000 are enrolled in the Our Home program. Census Bureau data from 2024 shows the number of adults in Arkansas without health insurance is at 9.4%.
That was KUAF's Daniel Carruth reporting. The new world screwworm hasn't yet made its way to Arkansas, but cattle farmers and state officials are worried as the pest spreads through a neighboring state. Little Rock Public Radio's Maggie Ryan sat down with rural issues reporter Amir Mahmood to learn more.
So, what is the new world screwworm?
For starters, the name is a bit misleading. The new world screwworm is a parasitic maggot that grows up to become a fly. They're more worm-like when they're young, and also scarier.
Scarier?
I sure think so. The mama fly looks for open wounds and mucous membranes to lay her eggs. After hatching, the larvae munch on the host's flesh. They burrow into the flesh like a screw feeding into wood. The majority of cases in the U.S. right now are in livestock, but a ton of animals can be infected, like dogs, wild boars, and deer. Oh, and people can be infected with screwworm, too.
Yikes.
I'll say, Texas Department of Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller says wounds affected by screwworm are like something out of a horror movie.
And this isn't the first time the screwworm has made it to the U.S., right?
Right. Screwworm was an issue here for decades. A coordinated response from the USDA led to its eradication in the 70s. Just listen to this documentary from 1960.
Bloody discharge, foul odor, and the larvae embedded full length as their mouth hooks tear into living flesh are the symptoms of a screwworm infestation.
That was Roundup, a documentary by the U.S. Department of Energy.
Vintage.
Yep. Don Hubble, a cattle rancher and the president of the Arkansas Cattlemen's Association, says he was around when screwworm was a constant risk for cattle ranchers.
I was 10 in 1970, so, but now I went everywhere with my dad on the ranch, you know, and I asked him, he's 90, and I asked him if he ever remembered having a screwworm problem, and he didn't run a lot of cows, you know, maybe 100 cows, whatever, but he said he remembered one calf that got screwworms, and he treated it, and he said he got him, you know, he fixed him up, and he lived to sell day, you know, but if he had not treated that animal, he could have had more.
Work to eradicate the pests back then included releasing sterile flies. These are infertile flies treated with radiation. The female flies only mate once, so if they mate with a sterile male, that stops one line of reproduction. Release enough sterile flies into an environment, and you've got a real chance at wiping out the pest. The screwworm was pushed back to south of Panama, and for decades, sterile fly releases acted as a border for the screwworm. But 3 years ago, flies got past that border and have been inching their way to the U.S. ever since.
Do we know how they got through?
That's a good question. One that still remains a bit unclear. Here are some of the factors that could have had an impact. First, sterile flies aren't a perfect solution. They do work, but as I'll explain later, some think they might be better suited as part of a larger response. Second, it's tough to coordinate with other countries. Policies and policymakers change, which can complicate things like keeping screwworm at bay. Third, migration, globalization, trade, all of those could play a factor in this. It's possible a cow infected with screwworm slipped through the cracks, or another infected animal made it past the sterile fly border.
Okay, is there anything else?
Well, of course, there's a bit of bad luck involved. For example, a plane crashed in Mexico as it was releasing sterile flies about a year ago. 3 people died. This probably wasn't the biggest factor, but things like that sure don't help.
So the screwworm is now in the U.S. What's the government doing to address it?
So far, the name of the game is still sterile flies. There are critics of this approach, like Commissioner Miller. He says he doesn't like that the USDA is predominantly focused on sterile flies when another effective method exists.
We have a very efficient system, and it's a USDA proven program. They used it for about 8 years. It's called the SWASS system, S-W-A-S-S, Screwworm Adult Suppression System. And just to boil it down to simple form, it's a fly bait, just like you can go buy at the hardware store. We put it out in the 70s and 80s. It killed 80 to 95% of the flies with a suppressed population. Then you could come in for sterile flies and they worked.
He says better reporting standards that incentivize communication between cattle ranchers and agencies is also a critical component to the ongoing response. The USDA has been investing in sterile fly infrastructure so they can release more. They are also working on creating technology that ensures all irradiated flies are males. This would effectively double the sterile fly output.
So what is Arkansas doing to prevent the spread of screwworm into our state?
Cows coming into Arkansas from a screwworm-infested zone in Texas need to be checked by a veterinarian before entering the state. Of course, Texas cattle will still come into Arkansas, according to Arkansas Cattlemen's Association Vice President Michelle Horton.
By no means are the border from Arkansas to Texas closed, just adding a precaution of if something's coming out of a place that has New World screwworm cases, that it's been looked at by a veterinarian to confirm that they're not bringing it over to the line to Arkansas.
A spokesperson for the Arkansas Department of Agriculture says enhanced reporting that allows veterinarians to upload photos, location information, and case descriptions is also being used in the response. The spokesperson also highlighted partnerships with other industry groups.
Okay, is there anything else?
Keeping screwworm out of Arkansas is crucial. Hubble says Arkansas just doesn't have the beef processing infrastructure of Texas. So the state's cattle ranchers rely on transporting cows more than Texas does. Oh, and one more thing. Horton says beef consumers won't be affected by the screwworm outbreak. Only safe meat is sent to be processed, and there are regulations in place to ensure beef quality and safety, she says.
Okay, that's Little Rock Public Radio's Amir Mahmood sharing some of his reporting on the New World screwworm. Amir, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Maggie.
And that story is made possible through support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The number of people in Northwest Arkansas is increasing. The number of jobs is also increasing, but alignment of people and jobs doesn't align perfectly. Addressing those gaps is inspiration for a new report commissioned by the Walton Family Foundation. The report indicates the region is doing a better job providing pathways for entering high-demand job sectors. KUAF's Kyle Kellams spoke with Tara Walden, Senior Program Officer at the Foundation. She says there are more students working toward in-demand careers.
A couple of the shifts that we saw over time is we've seen more students or a larger percentage of students enrolling in things around like medical skills, pre-engineering, some growth in construction technology, areas that we all know are starting to really boom in this area, and which students could access them with a high school diploma or perhaps an additional certification on top of that, but they could go into the workforce. There are thousands of jobs available in those areas, making more than $20 an hour immediately. And so we've seen growth in those pathways. We've seen some shift away from some enrollment in some of the agriculture-associated pathways where we see fewer opportunities for high-wage, high-demand jobs post-graduation.
How does that shift happen? Is it school districts? Is it municipalities? Is it a combination?
I don't think we can point to a single factor that led to some of those shifts, but I think there are a couple of things that we know have shifted over time. One has been the state policy and legislative changes that have taken place. So both the LEARNS Act and the Access Act in 23 and then 2025 made shifts that impacted these pathways. So they established requirements around schools having at least one H2 pathway, meaning a pathway that's in a high wage, high demand field. They established more access to concurrent enrollment, so students could start taking some college courses while they're in high school. And we know that those types of shifts have then shifted the behaviors of some school districts. And school districts are really thinking about how do they serve the breadth of the population, some of whom may be going directly into college and others who may be going in directly into the workforce or some other kind of training program. So I think we've seen some state policy change. I think we've seen individual school districts looking at their data over time from our analysis and the data that they have and the combination of those things. And frankly, a more open conversation that's about how do we prepare every student for what they want to do, what interests them, but also what will lead to economic mobility. That conversation, I think, has broadened. It's ebbed and flowed between being college only or career only. And I think what we see now across the nation and certainly here is that it's a college and career conversation.
We've been hearing for more than a decade how there is a gap in Northwest Arkansas between people seeking medical attention or medical specialties and the number of people available to provide that service. Is healthcare, have we seen more pathways, enablers to get young people interested in healthcare professions?
Yeah, I would say that what we saw in this analysis is that healthcare is certainly an area where we're seeing more high school students have interest in healthcare, in what we call medical skills, which could be things like a certified nursing assistant all the way up through an LPN. So we have students who are becoming EMT certified in high school. We have students who have become nursing certified, right? So we're seeing more students with interest in those pathways. And I think we're also seeing beyond high school. We're seeing more programs like Upskill Northwest Arkansas who are taking and helping retrain or upskill people that are working in other fields. So this report is focused on K-12, but I think we see K-12 as one piece of solving that puzzle around the healthcare workforce. And then we know that we need to continue to focus on upskilling adults who are already working in medical services or in other careers and want to pivot into some of those patient-based service roles.
Are there some of the growth sectors, growth industries that we don't have enough people to fill those jobs that are still not being well represented in pathways?
Yeah, I think what we see in this study is, especially at the K-12 level, there are a handful of regional priority sectors that are underdeveloped at this point in time, meaning that there are not enough students enrolling in those pathways to help meet what we see as the coming workforce demand. And I think some of those are not entirely surprising based on what we're hearing from employers in the area, things like advanced manufacturing, building and construction, transportation and logistics, things related to supply chain management, I would say. And then technology, which we see is really cross-cutting because there are kind of technology roles within all of those sectors. I think those areas are all ones that the report highlights as being underdeveloped, meaning that we need to think, how do we tackle that at a regional level? How do we get more students enrolled in those types of programs in K-12? And then how do we think about the existing workforce as well?
Are there more pathways available for students in larger high schools or school districts than the smaller ones?
I think one of the things the report showed is that our four largest school districts have students enrolled in all of the regional priority sectors. Many of our smaller districts, students in those districts lack access to some of those pathways. That may be because their school doesn't have an opportunity to enroll in those pathways, or the school is partnering with someone and a student would have to travel to get to that opportunity and is unable to do so. And so I think one of the themes we saw emerge in this report, and we're really thinking about in terms of what the Walton Family Foundation will do going forward, is how do we take more of a regional approach to this? How do we think about those small districts and how we support them as a consortium or as a group to work in partnership on tackling this? Because no individual small school district is going to tackle the workforce needs for the entire region, right? If we're thinking about workforce across an area, then we need to be thinking about all the schools in that area and not thinking about this as an individual school district challenge to solve.
That was Tara Wallen, Senior Program Officer at the Walton Family Foundation, speaking with KUAF's Kyle Kellums. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.